Hello, I'm Amanda Malgiri, Assistant Editor at Search CRM, and you're listening to the August installment of our podcast series, Creating Customer Value with Peppers and Rogers. This month, Don Peppers joins us to discuss how customer value changes over time. Don answers four questions from Search CRM readers on building customer value in a down economy, creating loyal B2B customers, establishing loyalty programs based on a customer's future value, and cross-selling during welcome calls.
Question: how does the weak economy and the rising prices of gas and other consumer goods change the way companies create value for their customers? Well, obviously, the economy is cyclical, and there's nothing anyone can do about that. It's like the weather, sometimes stormy, sometimes balmy, other times just lousy. But people still have to buy things. Everyone still needs to go out in the weather once in a while. It's important to recognize that the economy affects everyone, not just you, but your competitors as well. If a bear is chasing you and a friend through the woods, you don't necessarily have to be able to outrun the bear to survive, but you do have to outrun your friend. The economy's cycles affect different customers and companies differently. For a company, in stormy economic times, it's vital to have a good perspective on which customers are the best, i.e., which ones are most likely to keep buying even during the downturn, because this is what will allow you to be competitively successful. Even in the worst economy imaginable, some customers will still be buying, right? In a down economy, success will often boil down to being smarter than your competitor with respect to knowing which customers are the most valuable. Again, you're not outrunning the bad economy. You're simply outrunning your competitor. But when it comes to creating value for customers, stormy economic times present a different set of challenges, because in a downturn, many customers, including the more valuable ones, will be relatively more interested in straightforward savings. They won't want bells and whistles, special two-for-ones, contests, sweepstakes, premiums. They will be mostly interested in price and value. And this won't be true for all customers, because customers are all unique and different, but it will be generally true for most customers. In a nutshell, to create value for customers in a weak economy, you need to focus on the basics and do them very, very well. Don't waste your time on frills and add-ons. Be brutal with your cost cutting, and then pass whatever savings you can generate directly through to your customers in a straightforward and transparent way. Next question. There's a lot of talk about customer value in B2C organizations, but what about B2B companies? How are B2B organizations managing and building customer value? Well, the surest way to create value for any customer is to earn and keep the trust of that customer. Research shows that trust is the single most important decision-making variable whenever a customer is deciding whether to buy from one competitor or another, in any developed market where product price and quality are roughly comparable, and that includes just about every market. Anyone who's listening to this podcast probably in that category. Companies that can be trusted by buyers to act in the buyer's interest are few and far between. Whenever a customer finds a company that can be trusted, it is worth some investment to ensure that the relationship continues. Now, in the B2B space, buyers may actually compete with other buyers. And depending on the business, the most effective strategy for ensuring that an effective buyer-seller relationship continues is to focus on constantly improving the trust, mutuality, and openness of the relationship. This means not just respecting the individual interests of each buyer, but also protecting the commercially confidential information provided by each buyer. There are several important ways in which a B2B situation differs considerably from a B2C situation. And most of these differences make it even more critical for the B2B organization to develop trust on the part of the customer. We used these B2B principles when we wrote our book, One-to-One B2B, Customer Development Strategies for the Business World, which first appeared in 2001. It's still available at Amazon and other online book retailers. But let me give you the principles. First, relationships within relationships. The first and obvious difference between selling to an individual and selling to a business is that a consumer is a single decision-making unit, but a business is not. A business is composed of a number of distinct individuals. Many different people will have influence on the decision-making process at a business. So the B2B company is constantly trying to dig deeper, to probe beneath the surface of its relationship with the organization as a customer in order to uncover its relationships with the individual decision makers and influencers within that organization. Also, account development selling. Because of the complex nature of organizations as customers, a B2B company is much more likely to view success not just in terms of how many new customers it can acquire, but in terms of how deeply it can penetrate its current customer accounts. A B2B company will pay attention not just to the sales volume with a particular customer, but also to the development variables, such as how many of the customer's divisions it does business with, or how many of the customer's executives it knows, and the importance of their influence within the customer organization. Account development strategies for a B2B client are a kind of share of customer marketing. And this has always been a natural activity for B2B organizations. What has changed recently, however, is the sophistication with which a B2B company can pursue its account development strategy because of the array of computer-based tools that are now available, including Salesforce automation systems, contact management software, database analytics, and so forth. At any rate, the principal goal of an account-penetrating B2B organization is finding products for its customers, not finding customers for its products. Another big B2B difference is that B2Bs have just a few large customers. While a B2C marketer is likely to sell to hundreds or thousands or maybe tens of millions of consumers, the B2B competitor often sells to just a few dozen or maybe a couple of hundred customers. So a B2C company can usually rely on a statistical analysis of its customer base to figure out what's going on at any point in time with any particular type of customer, but it's often much more difficult for a B2B company to generalize about its clients in any way because there are a lot fewer of them. Instead, the B2B must look at its customers individually, and often that means making what may amount to subjective judgments about each one. But that's what you pay the salespeople to do. Another difference is infrequent purchases. Because B2B products and services are often big ticket items, and this usually means the purchase cycle is long, there are sometimes lengthy periods of inactivity between actual purchase events. So more than is the case in the B2C company, a B2B firm must constantly be seeking to fill in these gaps between purchases by selling services, for instance, or by subscribing customers to particular services. Subscribing customers to your product by turning the product at least partly into some kind of ongoing service is a good way to operate, and it's especially true of B2Bs. Another big difference for B2B is channel complexity. Managing consumer relationships for a B2C organization often involves important channel issues, such as the company's relationship with its own dealers or with the independent retailers that sell its manufactured product. It can be complicated. But for the B2B enterprise, these same channel issues can be quite a bit more complex. Because the B2B product is often a more complicated and difficult product to install or use to begin with, the channel members in a B2B situation can often add a great deal of value to the overall process. In IT, for instance, you have value-added resellers. But in addition to the external selling channels, it's often the case that the, quote, channel organization is actually within the business customer itself. Because of the division of labor within any large business, purchasing agents and procurement departments often amount to nothing more than captive channel members, owned and operated by the business customer. So a B2B company should want to create the same types of channel relationships with the members of a customer's internal channel as it would create with external channel members. Another difference, knowledge-based selling. Because the products and services sold in a B2B context are sometimes highly complex, It is often advantageous to base the sales process on educating and training the customers. More than is the case in consumer marketing, because of the complex nature of its products, a B2B enterprise must educate its customers. A B2B will often find itself in the position of having to teach business customers how to use its product or service more productively, sometimes even having to teach customers why its product or service is beneficial at all. And that leads us to the next difference, which is that B2B companies tend to help clients manage themselves. That's what they focus on. Ultimately, the strongest and best type of relationship with a business customer will be one in which the seller is actually helping the buyer to manage its own business. Businesses are not usually simple operations. As customers, businesses often have problems that a selling organization can help with. It's our belief that in the broad arena of B2B commerce, organizations will rise or fall on the basis of their ability to cultivate one-to-one relationships with their customers and earn their trust. Question: is it possible to create a loyalty program that will reward customers based on their future value instead of their current value? You know, we may have to dissect your premise here first, I think. By our definition, a customer's current value is best captured in terms of his or her lifetime value, which is the net present value of the future stream of profit attributable to that customer. Clearly, by this definition, a customer's current value is based on future profit, right? But a customer's future value is really the customer's lifetime value measured sometime in the future. From the nature of your question, we doubt this is what you were thinking, but it's still worth pointing out that any marketing program designed to increase a customer's lifetime value by increasing the customer's loyalty, for instance, or cross sales or likelihood to recommend others, any of those kinds of programs will be highly beneficial to a company. But most loyalty programs are not that well thought out, and we can count on the fingers of one hand the number of companies that have begun tracking changes in lifetime value as a tool for assessing their marketing programs. You can read all about this in our book, Return on Customer, Creating Maximum Value from Your Scarcest Resource, which we wrote in 2005. Frankly, I think it's more likely that your question has to do with whether a loyalty program can be designed to encourage customers to buy more in the future rather than simply rewarding them for what they just bought. And this is a very common problem that afflicts many loyalty programs. You need to use your loyalty program to reward the kinds of behaviors that most likely indicate future buying. Let me give you some examples. A credit card company will find that if a husband and wife are both active users of the same credit card account, the likelihood that they will leave the franchise is greatly reduced when it's compared to the likelihood that either one of them would leave if they had the same account but their spouse wasn't on it. So, if you have a married couple with only one half of the couple subscribed to your credit card, use your loyalty program to provide a handsome reward for signing the other one up and getting them to activate. That's a way to increase future buying. A retail store will probably find that subscribers to the company's email newsletter will be more likely to come into the store to buy things in the future. So, use your loyalty program to reward subscribing to the email newsletter. Subscribe to our newsletter, get these rewards. A car dealer knows that someone who recommends the dealership to another customer is likely to be more loyal himself, and the person referred is also likely to be more valuable if they buy. So, use your loyalty program to reward referrals. Here's a question. Our call center makes welcome calls to new customers on a daily basis. Is it a bad idea to cross-sell during the welcome call? Do we run the risk of alienating our new customers and therefore destroying our chance of building long-term customer value? Well, in a word, yes. This is a very bad idea. Most people do not like to be telemarketed to, period. That's why the vast majority of phone numbers have already been placed on the do not call list in this country. Now, it's fine and grand for you to call me to welcome me as a new customer, and then perhaps you explain some details of the service offered, etc. That's a friendly call. That's worth taking my time to answer the phone. But the minute that this welcome call becomes a sales pitch, I will turn off completely. When that happens, you will be destroying my trust in you, because I thought, silly me, that you were just calling to be helpful. I thought you were calling me because it was in my interest for you to do so. Now I find out you're really calling me because it's in your interest too. So, unless I'm a lonely widower living on a farm 10 miles from the nearest town and in desperate need of human contact, any contact, then it's highly unlikely that I won't be irritated by this kind of a call. If you want to cross-sell to me by phone, you need to get my permission to do this. There's nothing wrong with asking me for that permission during the welcome call, but just don't presume I'll give it to you. Now, here's what might happen when you take my answer back to your management team about the welcome calls. It's quite possible that the manager in charge of the welcome call program will say, hey, look at the sales we're generating with these calls. For every 20 calls we make, we generate one additional sale, netting a profit of $50 on average, which helps pay for the cost of the calls. How can anyone suggest that we cancel this kind of a program? All you need to do is point out that if you make one sale for every 20 calls, or one sale for every 10 calls, or one sale for every 50 calls, this means you made no sale the overwhelming majority of the time. And that each time you didn't make a sale, there was some chance, a very large chance, that the customer being solicited has become just a smidge less likely to buy in the future. So, in return for generating one current sale for every 20 calls, you have eroded the value of 19 other customers. The only reason your program looks profitable is because you're not having to record the loss in value from these refusers. You're only counting the stuff in the win column because that's easy to tally, their current sales. The loss column is almost certainly much larger. It's just not as easy to tabulate. But it's not impossible. You want to quantify the damage, there's a simple way to do it. Do a control test. Use cross-selling in welcome calls to 1,000 customers as per usual, but make another 1,000 calls to a statistically identical group of 1,000 customers with no cross-selling in the call. And then track each group's buying and performance over time. I can almost guarantee that when you do the back-end analysis, you'll find that the no cross-selling welcome calls will generate far more value for the firm over the long term.
That's it for our podcast this month. Thanks to Don Peppers for joining us. Stay tuned for next month's installment, where we discuss the link between customer trust, customer loyalty, and shareholder value. Until next time, I'm Amanda Malagiri for Search CRM.